We have been asked to remind you to attend chapels. You know, there was a time when chapels were absolutely mandatory. I remember Tom Alberts used to take roll every morning in chapel and read off every student's name and here, present. And seems like another dispensation, probably was, but anyway, but it was good because everybody showed up. You know, everybody was there and you had full participation and that whole thing. And it was good. But so anyway, and there's noon chapels this semester as well. So, for example, if you've got an 11 o'clock class, you get out at noon. If you don't have to leave right away for work or something, you can go in there and Lumen Sonides is going to be leading those. And those will be prayer. And he'll be leading in prayer. This guy's a prayer warrior.
Yes.
And those would be good. I'm also supposed to ask you to remember to be here on time. I should try to do the same thing.
You're doing good.
Oh, yes. And I'm supposed to encourage you to pick up student bulletins. I'm supposed to tell you that you're no longer required to wear name tags. And new students are no longer being issued name tags because
he's given us his name.
I don't know why. I guess that's grace or something. Oh yes, and classroom temperature. The temperature for our classrooms is preset at 69 degrees. 69 degrees. The rooms are purposely kept a little on the cooler side to conserve energy. If your students are cold, encourage them to wear warmer clothing on cold days. If the room is truly cold, then operations does want to hear from you so the problem can be rectified. And any students that die, call Mark Elder, he will come over and pray for them. Raise them from the dead. Okay, tape students. Oh yes, I'm also supposed to remind students to pick up their work from last semester in the library. It's all laid out there neatly in piles according to the class name. And all papers that are not claimed by January 22nd will be removed, and we'll have a bonfire fellowship out by Chapel Court with those. And students are not to write their names on the roll sheet if they're not on the roll sheet, and that's that. Okay.
Greg, are we going to discuss the vehicle load assignment that we don't get back? Or are you just going to do it in our house?
We're turning that back to the library, right?
Yeah.
So everybody may not have necessarily picked that up yet. But, if you want to, we could set aside the beginning portion of a class, maybe next week or something, 5 minutes or so, and discuss it. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to ask you to do then is, if you're listening here or on tape, pick up the Day of the Lord assignment ASAP. And he was the son of Asaph. Asaph had Asaph, and Asaph had Hemath, and Hemath had Hamath. And you know how it goes in the genealogies. But anyway, that means as soon as possible for those of you who were born yesterday. And make sure that you bring them next week. And then we will discuss them. Robbie obviously is got his axe and he's sharpening it on the whetstone and getting it all ready. And sure, we can discuss that. I'll wear my asbestos armor-plated protective helmet and suit. So let's plan on doing that then. We'll bring them to class. And so when you pick them up and when you look at your grade, don't let the tear stains fall on that onion skin paper. It'll leave these little spots. But look at it and write down if you have any questions or comments, seriously, and then bring them to class and we'll kind of take care of it all. Because I've graded this over a number of years now, a number of times, and there are patterns that I see in some of the answers. And there's one question particularly on there that students, by and large, miss the answer to. And it's not because it's a trick question, I don't think, or even that it's poorly worded, but it's that they're just seeing part of the truth. And so that usually the answer that they give to that is a partial answer. And so it's not totally correct, and so the grade is reflective of that a lot of times. Although they usually end up getting the right bottom line answer, you know, for the last one on the page, you know, what events does it make up and so forth, they can spit that out before they've taken minor prophets, because they've taken apocalypse, right? But there's a couple questions before that that usually throws a few people for a loop. So sure, we can talk about that next week. But Robbie, you remind me, okay, like next Wednesday or Thursday, one or the other, maybe Thursday. All right. Or just even in class. Okay, Hosea chapter 4. I believe we're on verse 15. Does that sound right? 4:15. How does it feel in here to you? Does it feel too chill? It feels too warm, if anything, to me in here. It doesn't feel too cold. 6:04 is another matter, but here it doesn't feel that bad. All right, 4:15. Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend. And come not ye unto Gilgal, neither go ye up to Beth Aven, nor swear the Lord liveth. So he's saying, and he's not condoning Israel's sin, but he's saying, okay, Israel, remember Northern Kingdom that Hosea is ministering to here, you are playing the harlot, and of course this alludes back to the idea of Gomer being unfaithful to her husband Hosea, and now the nation represented by that type, going out and worshiping these other gods, yet, so he's in a sense resigned himself, you know, speaking out of the matter of men, to the fact that that's what Israel's going to do. They're pretty set in their ways. 19 kings in that kingdom, all wicked, none following the Lord. Yet, let not Judah offend. So he's warning Judah not to follow in the footsteps of what Jeremiah calls their treacherous sister, Israel. And NAS renders, do not let Judah become guilty. Well, this warning went unheeded by and large, because it was only 100 years or so after Israel went into captivity that Judah had to as well, because of their unfaithfulness to the Lord. They should have learned it. They should have learned from the object lesson that they had of their brethren up in the north, that, you know, what you sow you're going to reap. But they didn't. And then he says, don't come up to Gilgal and Beth Aven. Of course, these are all places that had become places of idolatrous worship. And he seems to be saying now to the Jews in Judah not to come up to these places of idolatrous worship up in Israel. Like Paul says, what fellowship has light with darkness? You know, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, it's that same basic admonition. And there's a play on words here, because he's really talking about Beth El, you know, Bethel, where Jacob was at one time, where, you know, saw the vision of God and so forth. But now it has become Beth Aven, which means house of vanity. So it was Bethel, house of God. Now it's Beth Aven, house of vanity. We've seen that, I think, point earlier. Also, you can put Amos 4:4 here with that. 16, for Israel slideth back as a backsliding heifer. Now the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place. Better translation is, they are stubborn as a stubborn heifer. It's not backsliding as if they were walking up this hill that is so steep that it's impossible to keep your footing, and you just kind of find yourself inevitably, inexorably sliding back. It's the image rather of a heifer who the farmer is trying to slip the yoke over the neck so that they can put it in the, you know, work plow and it'll work, but it's stubborn, it's rebellious, and it's jerking its head and kicking and drawing back and so forth. And so it's a much stronger image, is the point that I'm making. And so it makes it a lot more clear what backsliding is. It's not an inexorable, inevitable slide down because it's just too hard. It's a kicking against God and a fighting. It's an act of the conscious act of the will to fight against what God is trying to get one to do. That's what it is. And like Paul, it's hard for thee to kick against the pricks, Saul, Jesus told him in Acts chapter 9 there when he was converted. Same idea. That means that God had been convicting Paul for a long time about his manner of life and persecuting the Christians and so forth. And Paul had been, you know, sloughing it off and not listening to it. No, that's not God and so forth or whatever. And finally God was able to get through to him. But then he says the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place. So here he changes the metaphor to the idea of a lamb. And, you know, the sheep, particularly, you know, young sheep, lambs, you know, a lamb refers to a sheep that's a year old or less, are very timid, and they're very gregarious animals. You know, they flock, they live in herds and flocks. And so to turn a little lamb out into a desolate wilderness or some lonely pasture would be it would be a very difficult thing for it. There would be loneliness, there'd be the fear of the predatory animals and so forth. So he's saying in essence, you're not willing to come under my yoke or be submissive to me, under the heifer metaphor, and so you're going to be turned out into a large pasture. That's them going into a captivity in Assyria. And so they'll be without that protection and guidance of God. Verse 17, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Now he still seems to be addressing Judah here. You know, verse 15 or 16, 15, don't let Judah offend. So he seems to still be addressing Judah, and he's talking again about Israel, whom he here calls Ephraim. And he's saying they are joined to idols, and so let them alone. And this is, to me, one of the more poignant verses in Hosea, if not in all of the minor prophets or the prophets, because it's saying it's too late. You know, Paul says, he that is joined to an harlot is one body. And so they have joined themselves to idolatry to the point where they're so bound in it and so unwilling to get out of it that he's saying, Judah, don't have any kind of intercourse with them. Stay away from them in interaction because they have become one with that thing that they have lived so long with and wanted and worshipped. So it's a kind of a scary, you know, and sad commentary on Israel here. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 16 and 17 is the verse. This word joined, according to the commentator Feinberg, is a word that is employed often in speaking of binding with spells, you know, occult bondage, in other words. So he's saying, in a sense, Israel is held to this idolatry as though they are bound to it under a spell. And indeed, we know enough now about spiritual things to know that there were certainly demons and so forth involved in this. It was more than just, you know, a sin of the flesh or a decision of the will, but the demons had come in and taken over. All right, verse 18. Their drink is sour. They have committed whoredom continually. Her rulers with shame do love, give ye. This last phrase is a little bit ambiguous, but some render it, their rulers do love shame. They love shame. In other words, they love those things which are shameful and are not right. Rotherham renders this whole verse, their drinking bout having passed, they become unchaste. They loved wildly. A contempt became her great men. So the point seems to be that of excess and debauchery, and then the resultant dissipation in their lives. 19, the wind has bound her up in her wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. So here's another, it's a personification of the wind as though it was something that had wings and could, you know, like a great vulture or something, pick them up and carry them away. And so Israel will be swept away from their land. Remember how winds often represent demonic spirits, powers, and forces. And so here again we see the idea of demonism involved in it. Cross-reference Jeremiah chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. All right, number 5. Hear ye this, O priests, and hearken, ye house of Israel, and give ye ear, O house of the king, for judgment is toward you, because you have been a snare on Mizpah, and a net spread upon Tabor. judgment is toward you. The point is, this judgment is for you. In other words, it's meant for you. It's coming your way. Now, Mizpah and Tabor were hills. They would call them mountains. We would call them hills. And they were places where hunters went to hunt, like for birds, and they would spread their snares or nets out on these hills. And so he is talking to the leaders. Notice the house of the king and the priests. So this is basically an indictment against the leadership in the land. And he's saying, you have been like a snare and a net to the people. That you were responsible to guide and to protect, you have rather trapped them and snared them. Mizpah means watchtower, and Tabor means lofty place. So here's the idea of the privilege that goes along with the authority that they had. But remember, where there's authority, there's also responsibility. Where there's privilege, there's responsibility. So the point is, God had put these leaders in a lofty place, Tabor. And he had set them there to be watchers over his flock. The flock of his pasture. And there's the idea of watchtower, because they often built these tall towers to get up high enough to be able to see over a large flock or herd. But instead of watching over them and protecting them from their vantage point, they have become hunters, trapping them and snaring them. So here's oppression and civil dishonesty and corruption and so forth indicated. And the revolters are profound to make slaughter, though I have been a rebuker of them all. This profound is a root from a root which means to make deep, and it seems to carry the idea of going deep in the realm of slaughter. NAS renders it, the revolters have gone deep in depravity. So again, this is a very strong picture of a people, not of a people who have been trying to walk with God, but they've got some problems, they've got some sins and weaknesses, and even some unwillingnesses. But it's a people who have totally gone over the bluff. Verse 3. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me. For now, O Ephraim, thou committest whoredom, and Israel is defiled. He seems to be now restricting the meaning of Ephraim to the tribe of Ephraim. And when, as Ephraim goes, so goes Israel, the nation, the northern kingdom, as a whole. Because, of course, they were the most politically powerful tribe. The capital city of Samaria was located in Ephraim, and so on. And so they are singled out as being a leader. Just as, in our country, the media center is on the west, on the east coast, New York City, and of course Washington D.C. with our capital, and then L.A. on the west coast in terms of Hollywood and other entertainment industry, and these are kind of the leaders of the country, and as they go, so goes the country to a large extent at least. All right, verse 4. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God. For the spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them, and they have not known the Lord. Notice again here the idea of an unwillingness on their part to return. They don't even want to begin to return. You know the old saying, well, Lord, I'm not willing, but I'm willing to be made willing. Well, they're not even willing to be made willing. They're just flat out unwilling. And so they won't even frame their doings to try to return to the Lord. NAS renders this, their deeds will not allow them to return to their God. And then he talks here about a spirit. The spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them. So here again we see, and this is a greater number of allusions to demonic bondage than you see in most any of the Old Testament prophets, especially in this short of proximity. We've already seen a couple this morning, then this is another one even more clear. It's a spirit that's involved. Just like Gomer is an individual, she might have ended up yielding to this thing enough to where it took control. And as we would say, she needed deliverance from this because it was a power greater than her that was involved, that was driving her and compelling her to go off and to be unfaithful to her husband. And so with the nation as a whole. One remarked that he who will not yield to God's Spirit eventually cannot yield to God's Spirit because another spirit is in control. Here, Acts chapter 7, verse 51, Stephen said, "You stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, you do always resist the Holy Ghost. As your fathers did, so do ye. So the idea of continuing to resist stubbornly what God is trying to do. Verse 5, "And the pride of Israel does testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them." Here we see one of the, if you want to call it, root problems. And that is pride. Pride opens the door for spirits of deception to come in. And bondage. In fact, pride itself is a form of deception. Because pride is looking oneself, thinking of oneself higher than one ought to. And it involves a rebellion against God and so forth, even as Lucifer in the beginning. Here you can put Amos 6:8, where God said, "I abhor the excellency of Jacob." And then he says, "Judah also shall fall with them." So here's a progressive revelation. Because in 4:15 he just says, "Judah, let not Judah offend." Now he takes it a step further and lets us know Judah will offend. Even though they've been warned, God foreknows they're not going to listen to the warnings, ultimately. And that they will also, despite all of God's warnings, fall right along with Israel. So Israel fell in 722 B.C. Actually, Israel fell in about 931 B.C. But you know what I mean. That they lost out as a nation in 722. And then Judah, of course, in 605, beginning of the Babylonian captivity. Verse 6. "They shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek the Lord, but they shall not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them." Flocks and herds, because from these come the animals for sacrifice, the bullocks, the rams, the lambs, the goats, the pigeons, the turtle doves, and so forth. And so they're coming with all of these to try to placate the Lord. And he's saying it's not going to do any good, because without a heart of obedience and faith and faithfulness, all of these sacrifices will avail nothing. You know, like we're going to see in Micah, "The Lord has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Micah chapter 6, 6 through 8. 7, "They have dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they have begotten strange children, and now shall a month devour them with their portions." And strange children, of course, are the antitype of Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, and Lo Ammi. Israel being scattered, and not obtaining mercy, and then not being God's people. Now this phrase, "a month shall devour them with their portions," is a little bit ambiguous. But a month literally is a new moon. And he asks, "Now the new moon will devour them with their land." Two ways you could take it. One is that they are going to be carried away within 1 month. Now, not meaning that a month from the time that Hosea prophesied this, they're carried away, because they probably weren't. But that when the judgment falls, when it begins to come, the whole thing will be wrapped up within a month. It'll be kind of a quick work, a short work. Another way you could take it is to refer to the new moon as representing all of their feast days, because he had just talked about they're coming with their flocks and their herds, verse 6, but they won't be accepted. And so now the same thing, new moon, representing their feast days, their Sabbaths, their religious holidays. And so the point again would be, all of their sacrifices, their offerings, their keeping of the new moons and the feast days will avail them nothing. Because they rejected God and His covenant. According to Wordsworth, the Jews killed Jesus Christ on the new moon, and 40 years later, Jerusalem was destroyed during the new moon in AD 70. Verse 8, blow ye the cornet in Gibeah, and the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Beth Avon, after thee, O Benjamin. Now, the cornet and the trumpet were horns that were used to sound an alarm from the high hills to warn of the approach of the enemy. So he pictures the invasion as though it was happening now. Even though it wasn't, this is prophetic. And it's even coming down toward Benjamin, which is in Judah, of course. And so here again, it's a warning to the southern kingdom as well. Verse 9, Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. I wonder if any of you picked up the phrase day of rebuke as a parallel to the day of the Lord in your day of the Lord assignment. I don't know. But I think there's a possibility that it could be a parallel to it. Now notice, he says, among the tribes of Israel I have made known that which will surely be. God was faithful to an unfaithful people to never leave them without a witness of what was going to happen. Therefore, they never had an excuse, and then they were never able to stand before the Lord and say, well, you never told us that. Well, you never told us this is what would happen if we disobeyed you. No, he let them know. He gave them abundant, ample, and consistent testimony as to what was going to occur if they would walk with him, and what would occur if they didn't. You know, the curses and the blessings being one example of that. Here, Isaiah chapter 46 and verse 10. Then verse 10, the princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound. Bound referring to boundary marker. Therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. And of course, moving your neighbor's landmark, you know, going out at night and moving these boundary stones in order to make your plot of land bigger and his smaller was obviously a violation of the law, Deuteronomy 14:14. And he's saying this is what the princes or the leaders of Judah are like. They are a greedy, covetous, lawless people. And here they are the ones that are supposed to be, you know, giving the laws or enforcing the laws and so forth, and they're themselves violating them. Now perhaps the rulers of Judah were eager at the prospect of Israel going into captivity, of taking over their land. They were carried away. Instead of being awed at the judgment of God on their brethren to the north, and therefore repenting of their own sin, they just looked at it as an opportunity to go up into Ephraim and take some of that good land. And so, it seems like the whole object lesson of Israel's captivity was lost upon Judah. Verse 11. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. Now notice he talks about them walking after the commandment. He doesn't mean walking against a commandment, but he means walking in accordance with a commandment, which would seem ironic because if they were walking in accordance with God's commandments, why would they be oppressed and broken in judgment? Well, it's pretty obvious that this commandment cannot refer to God's commandments. The word for it, commandment, is tsav here. T-S-A-V. And it's found only twice, here and in Isaiah 28, verses 10 and 13. And it's probable that it's referring to the commandment of Jeroboam the first king of Israel, who commanded them to worship the golden calves. You know, these be thy gods, O Israel, that brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And it was made like a law. They were constrained for this idolatrous worship. Your references here are 1 Kings 12, 28, 32, and 33, and 2 Kings 10, 28 to 33. And remember that Jeroboam the first's successors on the throne, all the way down to Jeroboam the second even, continued in that same vein of idolatry. And so because they willingly followed the king's commandment instead of being more like a Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, who would not follow a king's commandment, you know, to worship other gods, because they willingly followed it, that's why they're oppressed and broken in judgment. I think we see a similar concept in Micah 6:16, where he rebukes Judah by saying, "The statutes of Omri are kept." Micah 6:16. And therefore it becomes parallel to Jesus' rebuke in Mark 7:7, where he says, "Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." Of course, we see that a lot in the church world today. The commandments of men in many places and ways have superseded the Word of God. And that's why many people find themselves oppressed and broken in judgment. NAS adds the word man's in order, I think, for the reader to not be confused here. And so they render it, 5:11. "Because he was determined to follow man's command." And they put man's in italics just so the reader would realize that they have supplied the word. And I think it is properly supplied there. At least mentally, if not in a Bible translation, because that's what he's referring to. 13. "When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you, nor cure you of your wound." In other words, when they saw their vulnerability, the judgments that were coming upon them, and so forth, rather than letting that drive them to the Lord to get help from Him and protection from Him, they went back to the old arm of flesh. You see, it's not a foregone conclusion that trials are going to drive someone to the Lord. It depends on what they do. Many people, when they see their weakness, their sin, their needs, their vulnerability, and so forth, they turn to something in this realm of this world, this earthly realm, whether it's anything. And it could be something that's not a bad thing intrinsically. It could be a husband or a wife, you know, or a spiritual connection or a job or whatever. But they will immerse themselves in that in hopes that that will be their security and that will protect them from these things that they fear and that are intimidating, instead of turning to the Lord. Jareb is a figurative title for the king of Assyria. There was no king of Assyria named Jareb, but it's a figurative title. It means he will contend. He will contend. And of course, the king of Assyria was one who contended with the kings of many nations, and he overcame them. So here they are turning to the one who is going to take them into captivity. Ephraim goes to the Assyrian. But not only could the Assyrian not heal them, he was the one who ended up taking them in captivity. So what does this represent but yielding to demons? You know, demon of isolation, a demon of hurt, a demon of retaliation, a demon of stoicism, a demon of legalism, a demon of what and ever. And they can not only not heal, but we end up being in bondage and in captivity to them and carried away out of our land, as it were. Yes? No, I'll go back and get it in just a sec. Now, some render this, in order to try to bring out the meaning of Jareb, instead of transliterating it, Jareb, they try to translate it. And so some have said king adversary or king quarrel. And then it becomes very clear what it represents, you know, typifies the devil. Jareb is also found in chapter 10, verse 6. All right, verse 12, he says, "Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness." So again, the point is simply that they are going to decay, you know, nationally. They will go into captivity. 14, "For I will be unto Ephraim as a lion, and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him." So he compares himself to a lion who so thoroughly overcomes his enemy, and there's nobody who will be able to deliver them. You know, when a lion runs into the flock of a herd of zebras, there's no other zebras that are able to protect the one that is being picked off. And the jackals and the hyenas keep their distance until the lions have eaten to their fill, and then when the lions leave, they come in and take what's left. But nobody is able to deliver. And so it is, when we have rejected God as our deliverer, there's nobody else left that can deliver us from the enemy. We certainly can't deliver ourselves. Now, if I was making chapter breaks, I probably would have I would finish chapter 6 right here after verse 14, because verse 15 is very closely linked contextually with the first three verses of chapter 6. And they even set it off by putting a paragraph mark, which is kind of strange. You got a mark for one verse, you know, verse 15 set off from the other, and then you start a new chapter. So perhaps it would have been better if they'd have put chapter 6 right there. It's not a real big deal. As long as you remember to always ignore a verse number or even a chapter number if it breaks up the continuity, the flow of the thought at all, because they're not in the originals. I will go and return to my place. Till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face, in their affliction they will seek me early. Now this is a tremendous statement, because it shows us what is going to precipitate the second coming of Jesus Christ. Because God came into his own, and his own received him not. He came in his Son, and they rejected him and his Son. And so he returned to his place. That is, as God, he returned to heaven. He left his earthly temple in Jesus. You know, Jesus ascended up into heaven, and he returned to his heavenly abode. Just like a lion. He may be continuing the metaphor of a lion here, who comes out and tears and devours and then returns to his den. And he's not going to come back until they acknowledge their offense and seek his face. I want to say time element, but it's not a time element. It's the event key, which again precipitates the second coming. You see, when you look at Bible prophecy, more than looking at it from the standpoint of years and months and days, you know, chronology, okay, AD 2000, what happens, and so many years and so forth. It's really what's going on, the actions that are going to precipitate God doing things. And so it's whenever the Jews do what he's saying here is when he's going to return. And of course, you look at your second coming prophecies, Zechariah 10, we're going to get into that in the end of the semester. They look upon me whom they've pierced and they mourn. And then the Lord returns, doesn't he? Chapter 14, he returns and his feet stand upon the Mount of Olives. And he fights for them as he did in the days of old, and so on and so forth. So it's not like, see, God isn't looking at it from the standpoint of calendar time. You know, like he's up there looking at his heavenly Rolex, and when there's a certain time, go! You know, he comes down from heaven. You know, regardless of what's going on down there. No, it's never regardless of what man's doing. It's always pinned to what man is doing and not to what the clock is doing. It's totally irrespective of the clock time. And so when God's people seek him, he comes, whenever that is. See, and we may not know when that is in terms of calendar time. And so this is where the church has really gotten into trouble over the years in getting into all this date setting, trying to figure out when instead of why. You know, why does he return? He returns because they're willing to acknowledge their offense and seek him. And of course, this becomes an overriding principle that applies not only to the second coming, but to the church throughout history. When the church seeks him, he comes. And he ministers to them, and he's in their presence. When they don't, then he returns to his place. You know, draw near unto God, and he will draw near unto you, James said. And so this is the right way of looking at Bible prophecy. Till they acknowledge, Jesus Christ will not return physically to this earth until his people, his covenant people, the Jews, Israel, acknowledge their sin. Here, Leviticus 26, verse 40 and following, Jeremiah 29, 12 and 13, you shall go and seek me, and you shall find me when you seek me with your whole heart. The thing was true in Babylonian captivity. And see, this has a fulfillment there, too, when the Jews went into captivity and they finally sought him. Then he was found of them, and he brought him back after 70 years. So that was a fulfillment of it. And he says, in their affliction they will seek me early, literally at dawn. And at dawn is, of course, the earliest part of the day. So it's just another way of saying, earnestly, diligently, and soon they will seek me. at dawn when that Son of Righteousness arises with healing in his wings, Malachi 4:2. And of course, for the Jews, this is the Battle of Armageddon. This is the time of Jacob's trouble. And they will seek him early in that. And so this is a case of God allowing these afflictions to work for good. Because oftentimes in our afflictions, we seek God early. When everything's going our way, we tend toward complacency. You know, we tend toward lethargy and sin even. But when we're in affliction, then we begin to seek him at dawn. We begin to seek him early. And as a result, he comes to us and rescues us. All right, chapter 6 then, following right on. Come and let us return unto the Lord, for he has torn and he will heal us. He has smitten and he will bind us up. So just like the lion, maybe continuing that idea again, who, you know, tears the animals, God has torn the kingdom from them. God has scattered them. God has allowed them to be judged. 5:14, I will tear and go away. But the same one who scattered them will regather them. The same one who tore them will heal them if he will allow them to. And so as a result, here we see their heart at the end of time when they say, let's return. Because he will heal. He will bind up. Now they're beginning to have hope. This is the manifestation of hope. One of the first things that the devil robs from a saint of God, if he can, is hope. Because when they are living in hopelessness, there's no hope that I'll never be happy, I'll never make it with God, I'll never get rid of sin, I'll never be what Jesus wants me to be, I'll never... Then it's very easy to slide into apathy and lethargy and just I don't care attitude. But now you see they've got hope. Now the hope was always offered to them. The hope was always there. But they just never took it by faith. Now they will in their affliction. Verse 2, after 2 days he will revive us. In the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. Now there again was a partial fulfillment of this in the Jews' return from their Babylonian captivity. But also at the end of time is where you really see it fulfilled. Because he's also prophesying to Israel here, not just Judah. In fact, he's prophesying to Israel at least as much as he is to Judah. The whole thrust of the book is to Israel. Well, you know, 722, let's just round it off and say around 700 BC, they go into captivity. And they don't come back until 2,000 years after Jesus Christ's time. So that's about 2,700 years. Well, that's what they're saying. After 2 days, he will revive us. And in the third day, he will raise us up, and we will live in his sight. Remember, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. Amen. And 1,000 years is as a day. So it's after 2 days, when you look at it from Hosea's time, and it's exactly 2 days when you look at it from Jesus Christ's time, that he will revive them. They will be revived as a nation. Remember the Ezekiel Valley of Dry Bones picture in chapter 37. They're revived. They're resurrected nationally and spiritually. And then in the third day, and that's that third 1,000-year period after Jesus Christ, which of course is the millennium, it says we will live in his sight. And so there they are prominent among the nations at that time. Here's 2 Peter 3:8. So I believe that this is the interpretation of it. Now, some, I think there might have been a scholar or two who felt that there might be a literal 2 days application in terms of from the time of the Battle of Armageddon till the time that God revives them nationally and raises them up, it's 2 days. And I will not discount the possibility that that may not also be there as well, but I certainly wouldn't put this one as the interpretation over the first one that I gave you. I would just put this one as a possibility under it, but it's the other one is definitely what's involved. This is only possibly here. Chapter 5, verse 15. Joel chapter 2, verse 17. Now it's tempting to try to make a spiritual application, third of all, to Jesus Christ being raised up on the third day to give life unto all. But the problem with that is that Jesus Christ did not raise up on the third day, you know, after 2 days, on the third day. He was raised up after 3 days and three nights. So you've got, you have to shoehorn in, kind of, in order to make it fit here. And so I just, I really don't make that applicable to that. It'd be nice to, but if it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. In the third day, we will live in His sight. So they realize that there's life in God. Paul says, "For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead?" Romans 11:15. And in Ezekiel, there's the prophecy, "Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain that they may live." Ezekiel 37, verse 9. Live in His sight is literally, we will live before His face. Because He had said in 5:15 they would seek His face. And so now they're going to live before His face. And that's a Hebrew way of saying living in one's presence. Not only that, but it speaks of an intimate relationship. You know, to see the full expression of someone in their face rather than them turning away from you or something. And it speaks of full approval. A full manifestation, an intimate relationship, and full approval of them. Here, Psalm 17:16. 1 Corinthians 13:12. We shall see, you know, then face to face, now through the obscure mirror. And 1 John 3:2, we shall see Him as He is. Verse 3. Then shall we know if we follow on to know the Lord. His going forth is prepared as the morning, and He shall come unto us as the rain, as the latter and the former rain unto the earth. And here we hear it falling on the roof, even as we speak, which is really odd in Seattle. But now, I think you should omit the word if. It's in italics, and it's in this case unnecessary. They're actually saying, with NAS, so let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. And so they are urging and encouraging one another. You know, Hebrews, let us exhort one another daily. Encouraging one another to know God. And they know that they will know Him as they press on in that endeavor. And that's a contrast with chapter 4, verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. So here they were destroyed for lack of knowledge, but now they're pressing on toward that knowledge. Like Paul, that I may know Him. Philippians chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. And when they say His going forth is prepared as the morning, the point is, in the Hebrew, it is as certain as the morning. You know that the sun is going to rise in the morning. It's a certainty. It's something that you can bank on. It's a guarantee. And so it is with God's going forth, with His coming. It is that certain. Just like the rain that comes every year. So here God equates Himself with this rain. God Himself is the rain of revival. We read in Psalm 72, verse 6, Messiah will come down like rain on the mown grass. And His goings forth is prepared as the morning. The word goings forth is a kind of a general phrase that refers to all of the various things that God has done in history, His various actions on behalf of His people. In fact, it's almost a military term. It's sometimes used for an army going forth to war. And so here we get the idea of what God has done for us in His Son Jesus Christ in going against the enemy and destroying the works of the devil. It's the same Hebrew that we're going to find in Micah 5:2. You know, the prophecy of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, and it says, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. Same Hebrew. Verse 5, or 4, O Ephraim, what shall I do unto thee? Well, the last part of the verse 3, you know what's meant by the latter rain and the former rain into the earth. We've studied that before in Joel, so I don't need to belabor that point. O Ephraim, what shall I do unto thee? O Judah, what shall I do unto thee? For your goodness is as a morning cloud, and as the early dew it goes away. Remember I said in the introduction to Hosea it was a book that was not... There's kind of a contrast between Amos and Hosea, for example. Amos's book was more logically laid out, and he was more methodical and analytical, you know, to a point in his prophecies. you know, eight burdens and three messages and five visions. You know, it's kind of boom, boom, boom. Hosea's different. His book doesn't have that kind of an order to it. There's a lot more emotion in it. There's a lot of repetition in it. There's these waves of indignation on one hand and then poignant pleas and promises of mercy on the other hand. And this is an example of that. Because here, right after talking about how certain it is that God's going to come and bless His people and be the cause for them to have a rich harvest, then he comes back to the present time and he says, what am I going to do with you? That's really what he's saying. What am I going to do with you? Have you ever felt that sense of frustration with somebody else or with yourself or with a situation? What am I going to do? Can't live with them, can't live without them. And he feels that way about Ephraim and Judah, both of them, because their goodness was very short-lived. It was like the dew, that as soon as the morning sun comes up over the mountains, it dissipates very quickly. It's here one moment and gone the next. And so they were very inconsistent in their commitments to the Lord, in their walk with Him. So it's a real feeling of frustration that you sense there. Verse 5, therefore have I hewed them by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and thy judgments are as the light that goeth forth. So he likens his word to a sword, cutting the wicked in pieces. Remember how Samuel did that to King Agag in front of Saul there, the wicked. Hewing them by the prophets. So the prophets have had to bring many messages of judgment, which as it were hewed the people or cut them. Like Jeremiah's word was said to be a hammer that will break the people like rocks. Jeremiah 23:29. Or as Paul says, the word of God is like a two-edged sword which pierces and divides soul and spirit. Hebrews 4:12. Slain them by the words of my mouth. With that you can put Isaiah 11:4. With that mouth. Words of the mouth. And he says, your judgments are as the light that go forth. That is, the judgments or the punishments that God is going to bring upon Israel and upon Judah are going to be manifest to all people and to all nations, just like the light that goes forth in the morning is manifest and open to everybody. Verse 6, for I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. Now this is one of those climactic eternal verities. This is really the theme of all of the prophets and of all of the Bible. God wants the heart first, and then He wants the hands. He wants our love first, and then He wants our service and our sacrifice. And remember, we saw earlier in the chapter, they're going to come with their flocks and their herds, but the Lord will not accept them. See, same point here. Is that the last bell? All right, well, we'll just stop there. I have a little bit more to say on that verse. I can say a whole lot more about it, but I'll say a little bit more about it and get some cross-references when we come back Wednesday. Thanks. Do any of you feel like it's absolutely stifling in here? It's so hot that I need to talk to them, or is it just... you just take a coat off and everything's fine? Okay. Just let me know if we need to do any changes.
Yes. I have a question. I don't know.
Okay.
It's about illiterate.
Can you follow me into the lounge?
Sure.
Because you're in the next class. Well, I'd be glad to talk to you. It's just a lot more fun to talk to you.
Yeah. I want to see you.